Hello and welcome to the History of Singapore, episode 46, Selamat Hari Malaysia. Operation Cold Sore was done. Singapore's political opposition were arrested. The detainees would be tortured and interrogated, but Special Branch would find nothing new. There was no link to the Malayan Communist Party, no grand conspiracy, no plan to use violence. But Singapore's left wing was destroyed, and it is here that they fade from our history. And in the meantime, Singapore moved onwards towards merger. Remember, Singapore Prime Minister Lee Kuan Yew had launched his merger campaign in order to win the next election, and this had not changed. He had justified everything he had done over the past 2 years as necessary for merger. He had staked everything on the successful accomplishment of merger. So he still needed to deliver merger, or the PAP would be embarrassed, or worse, finished. So with the political detentions done, there should be no problem, right? Right? No. The negotiations over the economic aspects of merger were almost as fraught as the negotiations over the political aspects. The hard bargaining over the economic aspects nearly stopped Malaysia from happening. And indeed, in the end, it wasn't politics which would precipitate Malaysia's splitting apart. It was the economic issues which would drive the split. And they would be the same exact set of economic issues that caused so much difficulty before the formation of Malaysia. The negotiations over Singapore's financial and economic arrangements officially started in December 1962, just as it looked like the political issue was coming to a close, but they didn't actually get going till March 1963, when the political issue had actually ended. It seems probable that the timing was related. I won't go into all of the details over the financial and economic issues here, but allow me to summarize. There were two fundamental issues. The first was how to divide up financial and tax arrangements. Three basic questions shaped this issue. How much of Singapore's tax goes to Kuala Lumpur? How much does Singapore contribute for federal services like defense, foreign relations, and so on? And finally, who collects the taxes in Singapore, the federal government or the state government? This first issue was what was more important for Federation Finance Minister Tan Siew Sin. He wanted to make sure Singapore paid its bills. He wanted to make sure that the federal government got its fair share of the taxes. Being a part of Malaysia came with responsibilities to contribute to the common good. But there was also the issue of power. If Singapore retained responsibility for collecting its taxes and kept a disproportionate share of it, it would be able to use this financial power to supplement its already formidable political power to help Singapore political parties expand into Malaysia and become Malaysia-wide parties. Could be the PAP today, could be the Barisan Socialist tomorrow. Either way, the alliance did not want them leaving Singapore. And for Tan Siew Sin in particular, this was hugely important. Because which party would the PAP seek to first supplant in the alliance? Not UMNO or MIC. It would be the Malayan Chinese Association. And Tan Siew Sin, as the head of the Malayan Chinese Association, was not going to let that happen. No way. And he knew that the PAP knew this too. And the PAP knew that he knew that they knew. But for Singapore Finance Minister Goh Keng Swee, it was the second fundamental issue that was more important to him, and that was the common market. Remember that the Federation had a very different economy from Singapore. The Federation's economy was based on the extraction of raw materials. Singapore's was based on trade. The Federation had a much bigger internal market. Singapore's domestic market was small. And since the partition of Malaya into two territories in 1946, economic development of the two had proceeded in very different directions. The Federation had abundant raw materials and a large domestic market, so they were pursuing state-led development with tariff barriers to help build up domestic industry. That was logical for the Federation, but not for Singapore. Singapore's domestic market was small. They depended on free trade. So What Goh Keng Swee wanted was a common market with Malaysia so that Singapore's industry could sell its products to the rest of Malaysia. Now, Singapore's economy depended on entrepôt trade, of course, and Goh Keng Swee wanted to protect its free port. But Goh was not doing that because he was a principled free trader. Goh also wanted to take advantage of the Federation's tariffs. Goh wanted, quote, a situation in which Singapore's industries benefited from a protected Malaysian market, while at the same time hoping to retain most of her advantages of her free port. In short, Singapore wanted to have her cake of protected infant industries and access to the Malaysian market, and eat it too by retaining the entrepôt business. So Goh wanted to exploit and arbitrage Singapore's position in Malaysia by having free trade for Singapore and protection for the rest of Malaysia. And Tan Siew Sin was not stupid. He saw right through this, and he objected to Singapore, quote, having the best of both worlds, unquote. First of all, even without this, he feared that the lowering of Federation tariff walls to Singapore would generate undue competition from Singapore, which was a financial and economic powerhouse, where the cost of labour was lower, where the businesses were bigger and better connected. Basically, he feared that all Malayan industry would simply gravitate to Singapore, which would be indisputably the economic capital of Malaysia. This is the same issue which had stymied closer integration in Malaya in the years before World War II. Now, the same issue was stopping integration in the years afterwards. Singapore was too rich, too strong, too powerful. But if you take this inherent problem and then, on top of it, give Singapore the advantage of having a free trade port, then it could import raw materials on a tariff-free basis, and then, given duty-free access to Malaysia for its goods, it would enjoy a tremendous cost advantage over the rest of Malaysian industry, which would have to import materials that were subject to tariffs. And that was unfair. And again, this was also related to political power. The MCA's core supporters were Chinese merchants and industrialists in the big cities, KL, Penang, Ipoh, Taiping, Malacca, and they would see their business flee south to Singapore. So you see the fundamental conflict here. Tan Siew Sin had every incentive to play hardball with Goh Keng Swee and Lee Kuan Yew over this issue. And Goh Keng Swee and Lee Kuan Yew were determined not to solve the tax issue without first a resolution of the common market issue. So to cut a long story short, there were very tough and often very bitter talks throughout these 4 months. It was really acrimonious. Both sides dug in their heels. Angry statements were released to the press. The relationship between the Federation ministers and Lee Kuan Yew in particular grew progressively worse. Tan Siew Sin told the British, quote, the only obstacle in the way of an agreement was Lee. And he questioned whether it was necessary for Lee to be there. He complained that Lee was not amenable to reason. Complete surrender or brute force were the only two things which Lee understood, unquote. Even Federation Deputy Prime Minister Abdul Razak, who saw himself as the last Federation leader to really try to get along with Lee, got so frustrated with Lee that on one occasion he remarked, quote, while it was possible to negotiate with Goh Keng Swee, Lee Kuan Yew was impossible, unquote. Things got even worse in May when the PAP tried to split the Singapore alliance and approached Singapore UMNO for an alliance with the PAP for Singapore's upcoming elections as part of its openly stated long-term plan of replacing the MCA north of the causeway. The MCA, of course, was very upset by this, and Tan Siew Sin pointedly stated publicly that the MCA, not the PAP, was Singapore's best chance for political stability. That remark, of course, then upset Lee Kuan Yew, and things just got worse from there. British Commissioner Lord Selkirk, observing the negotiations, described at one point how Lee Kuan Yew, in front of Goh and Razak and Dr. Ismail, quote, had quite deliberately taken out the knuckle dusters and given Tan Siew Sin hell. He had taunted Tan by saying that if Tan thought he could run Singapore, he should come down and run an election here, unquote. You don't make friends by humiliating them first. And so, both sides dug in their heels and nothing changed until early July 1963. It again took the British to resolve the issue. With the creation of Malaysia looming at the end of August 1963, both sides arrived in London for a desperate attempt to solve the problem. The Federation ministers, led by Razak and Tan, were most concerned that Singapore would make a substantial $50 million contribution to the development of the Borneo states. They agreed in principle to the formation of the common market, but wanted to wait until after the formation of Malaysia to resolve the issue. And the least important issue for them was the issue of Singapore's tax contribution, which by this time both sides had managed to whittle down to a difference of just about $35 million, or about 1% of Singapore's tax revenue. But the Singapore government placed greater stress on the issue of the settlement of the common market arrangement, and Lee even went so far as to want the detailed arrangements for the common market included in the Malaysian constitution. The other issues they would only address after the common market was resolved. So the negotiation process was a war of attrition. Both sides bargained hard and gave in very little. British Secretary of State for the Commonwealth and for the colonies, Duncan Sandys, played honest broker, sitting down with both sides and trying to find common ground. But he also played hardball. He had long meetings with both sides, with no food or water, wearing them down. And finally, it resulted in compromises that made Malaysia possible. But it did not fundamentally alter the different mindsets on the two opposing sides, and the issues of Singapore's financial contribution were, unfortunately, only temporarily resolved, and they would be repeatedly reopened after the formation of Malaysia. But the problem ran much deeper than the issues. It was fundamentally how the politicians saw each other and Malaysia. There was deep mutual antipathy and mistrust from the beginning. Politicians from both sides went into negotiations with the attitude that they had to extract as many concessions as possible, that it was a zero-sum game. The negotiations were consequently tough and brutal and destroyed what little trust existed on both sides. It destroyed what little working relationship they had. Because from the beginning, they did not see Malaysia as reunification. They did not see Malaysia as one family coming back together, as the Barisan had, as Singapore's vernacular press had, as Singapore's people had. They saw it as a political arrangement that both had entered into for maximum benefit. Or, as the astute Lord Selkirk observed, merger was a sham since it was viewed, quote, by both sides as no more than a marriage of convenience, unquote. And again, on this occasion, as Coleslaw had, it was the British who helped resolve the differences between the two parties. But after the creation of Malaysia, the British would be gone, and then what would happen? More when we return. Welcome back. On 9th July 1963, the agreement for the establishment of Malaysia was signed in London by representatives of the UK, the Federation of Malaya, North Borneo, Sarawak, and Singapore. As part of this, the financial arrangements and common market for Singapore were agreed. So, with these arrangements for Malaysia settled, at least temporarily, now we can form Malaysia, right? Right? No. There would be one more twist to the tale. The inclusion of the Borneo territories in Malaysia was seen with great suspicion by Indonesia and the Philippines. The impression that they had was that the Borneo territories were being railroaded into Malaysia against the wishes of its own people. These were not wholly unreasonable claims. But then again, both Indonesia and the Philippines had its own claims in Borneo, so they weren't completely disinterested spectators. The Philippines' claim to North Borneo had been given unanimous support in a vote in the Philippine House of Representatives on the 24th of April 1962. While Indonesia, well, there are several explanations here. Following Indonesia's military occupation and diplomatic victory in Irian Barat, Sukarno may have been emboldened to extend Indonesia's dominance over its weaker neighbours. Or conversely, there may have been internal reasons. Sukarno may have felt compelled by the ongoing pressure by the Party Communist Indonesia and the general instability of Indonesian politics to divert attention towards a new foreign conflict. But publicly, Sukarno argued that Malaysia was a British puppet state, a neo-colonial experiment to perpetuate British influence in the region, with implications for Indonesia's national security. So he had to get involved. On the 20th of January 1963, Indonesian Foreign Minister Subandrio announced that Indonesia would pursue a policy of konfrontasi with Malaysia. Confrontation would be a long, drawn-out, undeclared war. We won't go into it here, as it would take too long. You could do an entire series on confrontation itself. But I have to admit, confrontation is a cool name for an undeclared war. Confrontation could be an action movie starring Iko Uwais and Joe Taslim. Anyway, the Tunku agreed to meet with Sukarno and Philippine President Diosdado Macapagal for a summit in Manila from 30th July to 5th August 1963. He agreed to postpone the formation of Malaysia in order to give the United Nations time to survey popular will in Borneo. This Manila summit alarmed Lee Kuan Yew, who, of course, was terrified that Malaysia would fail. And in spite of the Tunku's entreaties to please, please be patient and please keep your mouth shut, Lee Kuan Yew openly declared, quote, "We are not partners to the Manila Agreement, and therefore, as far as we are concerned, 31st August is still our Malaysia Day," unquote. He then flew to Jesselton in Kuching to meet with Donald Stevens and Stephen Kalong Lingkan, the respective chief ministers of North Borneo and Sarawak. And the three of them agreed a united front, calling on the Tunku to stick to 31st August 1963. Now, with very little time, the UN mission decided to use district elections in North Borneo and Sarawak as a proxy for popular opinion, based on whether they voted for pro-Malaysia politicians or not, and they also interviewed the politicians who were elected in those elections. And since nearly all major parties in both states had declared in favour of Malaysia, and anyway, people don't vote for politicians strictly on the basis of a single issue, this was not exactly the best proxy, but it was what they did in a very limited time. And their report, released on 14th September 1963, confirmed that a sizable majority, a clear majority of people in both states supported joining Malaysia. But in the meantime, despite the Tunku's entreaties, on the 31st of August 1963, Singapore, Sarawak and North Borneo, now renamed Sabah, declared de facto independence, to Kuala Lumpur's chagrin. In Singapore, the Singapore Legislative Assembly was dissolved on the 3rd of September 1963. Singapore's elections were underway and they were really deliberately timed. Nomination day was 12 September, which was the minimum amount of time permitted under the law between dissolution and nomination day, 9 days. Polling day was 21st September, a Saturday, also the minimum amount of time permitted between nomination day and polling day. This snap election stunned the opposition parties and left them scrambling to get organized. What's more, 3 of the 8 campaigning days were public holidays, including Malaysia Day, which meant opposition parties had little time to get their logistics organized, their posters and leaflets printed, their stages and microphones and lorries rented, and so on and so forth. Malaysia Day itself gave the PAP a massive and totally legitimate public relations exercise in which it could monopolize the media message, going into the election on the back of a triumphant creation of Malaysia. The delay in Malaysia and Singapore's declaration of independence allowed the PAP to say that they had delivered on their promise of independence via merger, but since the election was held before Malaysia Day, the rules of the election were controlled by the Singapore Elections Commission, and hence by the PAP, not by the Federal Elections Commission in KL, which probably would have been much more impartial. So the PAP used this timing masterfully. Indeed, David Marshall challenged the legality of the timing, pointing out that under the law, polling day had to be, quote, on a Saturday, not less than 9 days, unquote, after nomination day, which meant that polling day itself was not counted. That is, you have 9 days, then polling day, whereas polling day was going to be held on the 9th day after nomination day. In other words, 8 days then polling day. And after the election, the Chief Justice eventually ruled against Marshall because the returning officer of the election, as a servant of the Crown, remember, Singapore was still technically a colony at this point, the returning officer could not be sued and a private individual could not take action to vindicate public rights unless he had personally suffered damage. But the Chief Justice did not address the issue of whether Marshall was right or wrong. So technically, it seems, the 1963 general election was illegal. Not that it really matters now. Meanwhile, as I mentioned in episode 42, from May 1962 to September 1963, Lee Kuan Yew had been campaigning unofficially. He toured the island and in advance of his visits, roads and streetlights and other amenities were repaired. He spoke to constituents in four languages, listening to problems and ordering accompanying civil servants to act on them. And his tour ended, coincidentally or not, on the eve of nomination day, 11th September 1963. And the opposition also did themselves no favours. Cold Store had eliminated nearly all the talented, intelligent opposition politicians. So the remaining leaders were, let's face it, they weren't competent. The Barisan kept shooting itself in the foot with stupid, ill-considered actions and tactics. On the 22nd of April, they held a protest march over the detentions, which of course turned rowdy, and was used as an excuse to then arrest 12 of their leaders, including 10 assemblymen. And they were put on trial, distracting them at a crucial time. The trial began 7th August and ended on 29th August, barely 2 weeks before nomination day. 8 of the Barisan leaders, including 7 assemblymen, were convicted of a single charge of rioting, while 3 others, including Chairman Lee Siew Choh, were acquitted. But as a result of this, they were ill-prepared for the elections. And on nomination day, the Barisan pursued a stupid strategy where many of its leaders switched seats to stand against PAP ministers to try and knock out the PAP ministers, thus depriving themselves of the benefits of incumbency. And of course, the PAP used plenty of its now well-practiced dirty tactics. Since mid-1962, the PAP had been using the state security and justice systems to harass the Barisan. Early in the morning of nomination day on the 12th of September, Special Branch rounded up 17 opposition candidates who were held for questioning until after nominations had closed. Radio and TV airtime was, of course, offered to the four main parties, but the three opposition parties only learned of the schedule the day before, leaving them scrambling around to rearrange their schedule and find speakers. Public funds were used by the Ministry of Culture to issue a 64-page booklet called Democratic Socialism in Action, June 1959 to April 1963, which was blatant PAP propaganda. It didn't even try to hide it. It contained lines like, quote, "It is obvious to everyone that the PAP is the only well-organized and coherent force which can give leadership to the broad alliance of nationalist elements of our people." Unquote. The opposition parties found that sites had been booked up by the PAP, permits for rallies were hard to come by, and printing facilities for opposition parties almost unattainable, and so on and so forth. And of course, the PAP made strident appeals for national loyalty and solidarity in the face of confrontation. And yet, in spite of all this, on the 21st of September, the PAP just barely squeaked home. It won only 46.9% of the vote, and a number of their leaders, including Kenny Byrne, Tan Kia Gan, and Lee Kun Choi, lost their seats. Others won by the narrowest of margins. Toh Chin Chai won by 89 votes, Rajaratnam by 220 votes, Ong Pang Boon by 403 votes. But thanks to the first-past-the-post system, however, the PAP won 37 of 51 seats. The splitting of the anti-PAP votes saved it, as the PAP only won 19 seats outright. The Barisan won 33.2% of the vote, but only 13 seats, and the United People's Party won the last one, Ong Eng Guan in Hong Lim. The Barisan lost at least 8 seats due to the United People's Party splitting the vote. The UPP won 8.4% of the vote, and if its votes were given to the Barisan, because quite reasonably you wouldn't expect UPP voters to vote for the PAP, so if they had voted for the Barisan would have won 21 seats and the PAP just 29. In a sign of how far the PAP's position in Singapore politics had changed, it won every single seat it had lost in 1959. So all the middle class, upper class seats and the Malay-dominated seats all voted solidly for the PAP. Rural residents voted for the Barisan. 9 of the Barisan's 13 seats were rural. And the difference lay in the urban working class. The PAP won enough of their votes to win 26 out of 32 urban seats, but only 13 of them outright, as well as Sembawang, which was heavily composed of naval base workers. So the PAP had survived, and it would lead Singapore into Malaysia. But what was waiting for it? Because from the beginning, the environment was poisoned. The PAP's public criticism of the Tunku's decision to postpone Malaysia Day, for example, and Lee's unilateral declaration of de facto independence on 31st August, against the strong in public and private advice of the Tunku, left both sides really unhappy. So Malaysia was going to start with both sides mutually upset at the other. Why? Why did the PAP do this? Why did Lee Kuan Yew do this? And I think one reason is because it never forgot that its voters were in Singapore. It was terrified of losing ground to the Barisan or the Singapore Alliance, and so it played to the Singapore gallery at every opportunity. Because that's how Singapore politics worked. And this points to a deeper point. Since our separation from the rest of Malaya in 1946, Singapore's political traditions, its practices, attitudes, expectations had become too different from the Federation to allow many of our politicians, or indeed to allow Singaporeans, to easily adjust to the concept of a quiet, subordinate role within a Malay-dominated federal structure. Because of how the PAP sold merger, very few people, politicians or public, appear to have recognised that their slogan of independence through merger only meant independence from colonial rule. But independence also meant that Singapore would have less freedom after merger than before it, that our lives were going to fundamentally change, and not always for the better. And this illustrates the fundamental problem which this whole episode is about. It is the fundamental differences between Singapore and Kuala Lumpur, born out of the political incentive structure of the Federation and Singapore, as well as the personal temperament of the politicians on both sides, which led to deep antipathy between the Singapore and Kuala Lumpur ministers and made Malaysia almost, but not quite, but almost untenable from the beginning. For example, the way in which the Singapore-centred PAP had tried to negotiate the best possible economic terms for Singapore's entry reflected a style of politics suitable for Singapore. The PAP brought points of disagreement into the open. It sought to discuss, debate and quarrel in public because its power depended not on vote banks or institutionalised and socially rigidified constituencies of support, but upon direct appeal to voters, upon rational persuasion and argument. And it needed to show publicly that it was standing up for Singapore interests. But the alliance in the Federation was temperamentally and ideologically the opposite. It operated in a much more economically and socially and culturally and even politically diverse society, and so it was accustomed to compromise, conciliation, accommodation, consensus building before taking action on contentious issues. It sought to constantly depoliticize disruptive or even just potentially disruptive questions. It searched for and stressed agreement and unity. So the alliance parties believed in the resolution of conflict and the airing of different views behind closed doors in confidential and secretive surroundings. And I'm not saying this is better or worse. I'm saying that it's different. This is what had evolved in the Federation since 1946. It was how business was done there. And the PAP did not, could not play that game because Singapore was different. That was not how business was done in Singapore. Of course, the PAP, or more specifically Lee Kuan Yew, also were very much at fault because they actively did things. They actively screwed up. Lee's insensitivity to UMNO and MCA and MIC and more generally just Federation nationalist politics manifested as anything ranging from discourtesy and brashness to rudeness, insult, insolence, and open expressions of contempt. One contemporary observer called this kurang ajar, you know, and a very good example of this was the statement he made before Malaysia Day in response to Kuala Lumpur's condemnation of his unilateral declaration of independence. He said, unlike the Federation, Singapore had had to fight for independence. And even more insultingly, Lee talked of the quote-unquote naive approach of some people to whom power had been handed over, quote, on a silver platter with red ribbons by British royalty in uniform, unquote. And his lack of respect for some Federation leaders was often reciprocated, resulting in very strong personal antipathies which were to greatly affect the PAP alliance relationship after Malaysia Day. Of course, if the PAP was insensitive to alliance feelings, there were already also numerous occasions on which the alliance and certain of their leaders were also oversensitive to Singapore's government and to Lee Kuan Yew's actions and comments and criticism. And of course, politics also played a role, and in particular, the political rivalry between the PAP and the MCA would have a very negative impact on PAP alliance relations. As I mentioned, the PAP tried to supplant the MCA within the Singapore alliance and had a long-term plan of supplanting the MCA north of the causeway. As such, throughout the time Singapore was in Malaysia, it was never in the MCA's interest to engender a close and friendly relationship between PAP and UMNO. Quite the opposite, it was the MCA's direct interest to ensure that they did not like each other, that a relationship could never come about. And more broadly, right, the PAP's political challenge to the alliance would contribute greatly to separation. The potential for the PAP to form a second center of political power in Malaysia was clear even before Malaysia was formed. This is all the problems of why Tunku did not want to merge to begin with. And a prime example was, again, when Singapore declared de facto independence and was joined by Sarawak and Sabah, because Lee was seen as the principal instigator of this. Because Lee was the one who flew to Borneo and openly conferred with the leaders of Sabah and Sarawak on the necessity of sticking to August 31st and making declarations of independence. Thus, by the time Malaysia was created, there was an absence of trust and goodwill on both sides of the causeway. Because of the negotiations over coal store, over the rights of Singaporeans in Malaysia and their citizenship, over the financial and economic arrangements, over the timing of merger, and in addition, all the petty insults, the sensitivity, the political manoeuvring, and of course all the structural and cultural and social differences, because of all these disagreements and behaviour and the differences in incentives over 2 years, the small reservoir of friendship which had existed before 1961 had all but dried up by the time Malaysia was formed. Many of the seeds of the conflict between the alliance and the PAP in Malaysia had clearly already been sown before Malaysia was established. And it was in these auspicious circumstances that Malaysia came into being on 16th of September 1963. Selamat Hari Malaysia! May God help us all. As always, if you have any questions, comments, or feedback, please email me at thehistoryofsingapore@gmail.com or visit my webpage at thehistoryofsingapore.com. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit Patreon, patreon.com/pjthumb. Thank you very much and see you next week.